Hi, I am Edgar Robes, and with my colleague Anastasia Ropa, we will be talking about the way in which historical and semi-legendary figures, events, and artifacts associated with medieval Rus have been used in the Russian and Ukrainian political discourses. So, Anastasia, in your opinion, why is it important to talk about the history of medieval Rus today?
Given the current geopolitical situation in Western Europe, namely the war in Ukraine, it's important for us all to learn as much as possible about the history of the region and the events that led up to this military conflict. While the Middle Ages seem far away from the present war, medieval past, in particular historical and legendary figures associated with this past, have been recruited by both sides of the conflict. Both Russia and Ukraine have used medieval events, such as the baptism of Rus by Prince Vladimir, artifacts and historical figures, for example Prince Vladimir, Princess Olga, Boris and Gleb, Nestor the Chronicler, and many others, and also legendary heroes such as Ilya of Murom, for multiple purposes and audiences. These medieval allusions have been employed internally to boost morale in the country, also externally, to project a certain image to the outside world. Unfortunately, myths are always reductive and present a skewed and simplified picture of the historical past. Myths are also very attractive and enduring and can color the perception of an entire nation. In our work, we try to present a balanced account of the medieval past and reveal some ways in which Rus and everything that relates to it has been and still is presented in political discourse by Russia and Ukraine.
So, could you tell us more about the way this history is used by the participants in the war?
Okay, so medieval past has been used to boost the country's historical credentials. For a long time, it started before the war, and this use of medievalism has strengthened since the start of the war in 2014. One obvious example is the statue of Alexander Nevsky in Mariupol, and the use of this saint as a military patron in the Church of the Army, where Saint Alexander is depicted on a fresco with a half-drawn sword in his hands. And there he is surrounded by three other saints, all of them belonging to the ruling elites of medieval Kiev, Saint Vladimir, the baptizer of Rus, and the martyrs Boris and Gleb. But in the lower register of the fresco, there is a group of soldiers in modern uniforms, suggesting continuities between medieval and modern militants. So, the message, which is directed to Russian audiences, is clear. You are the descendants of Alexander Nevsky, who fought against the Teutonic Knights of the West and negotiated cleverly with the East.
In other words, Russia is using medieval Rus to indoctrinate its citizens and those who reside on the newly invaded territories, right? But the continuities are quite spurious, aren't they? Because Vladimir was the ruler of Kiev and Rus, which is not the same as the present-day Russia, despite similarities in names, isn't it?
Well, you're absolutely right. Kiev and Rus is a distant entity, and there is no direct line of succession from Kiev and Rus to Russia. But also, Kiev and Rus is not synonymous with Ukraine. Although Kiev is the capital of both Kiev and Rus and modern-day Ukraine, they differ, the two countries differ in terms of their territory, not to mention the fact that the name Ukraine was never applied to the land surrounding Kiev. It's not the same state. Obviously, it's a different political system.
Could you tell us more about this process of building continuity?
The logic which motivated Ukrainian national self-identification with Kiev and Rus, it's quite simple. You have Kiev as the capital of Kiev and Rus, also the capital of Ukraine. So it's like Kiev and Rus and Ukraine must be the same. And again, this is not a new idea. This national revival, national building of identity started already after the Second World War, and in particular it intensified in the 1980s. And this is the idea that one Ukrainian-Canadian sculptor, Leo Moll, has conveyed in his work in the run-up to the 100th anniversary of the baptism of Rus which took place in 988, he created a series of statues of Prince Vladimir all over Canada and Europe. One of his 1988 statues in London stands on the corner of Holland Park and Holland Park Avenue, and it bears the inscription Saint Vladimir, the ruler of Rus/Ukraine. So clearly he identifies these two countries as one and the same country. And yet in choosing his religion, both Princess Olga and Prince Vladimir made a conscious choice of joining the Orthodox Church with the seat in Constantinople, rather than the Rome-based Catholic Church. Basically, they opted for allegiance with Byzantium. Then we can look at other Leomol statues. One of them was erected in Rome. It was commissioned by the Pope, and there were a few other of Leomol's creations installed in Uniate churches and blessed by Catholic priests there. So if you look closely at the statue in Rome, which was opened in 2015 to mark the 1000th anniversary of the death of Saint Vladimir, we can see that the inscription is Baptizer of Rus/Ukraine. And also in 2015, the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, signed an order honoring the memory of Vladimir the Great on the millennial anniversary of his death. And this order credits Vladimir with the establishment, and I quote, of the medieval European state of Rus-Ukraine. So this is the actual words of the order signed by the president. And this double European Catholic connection, in antithesis to the supposed anti-Catholic and anti-European policy of Alexander Nevsky, at least that's what Russian sources try to highlight, that Alexander was pursuing this policy. It's also very ironic. Just like Alexander Nevsky, Vladimir the Great is known to have rejected the offer of adopting Catholicism. This event is recorded in the Primary Chronicle of Rus, and in the 19th century, with its pan-European national romanticism movement and the work for all since medieval, the Baltic German painter Ivan Egging, who was active in the Russian Empire, created the canvas, Prince Vladimir is choosing the religion. Egging was the illegitimate son of Curonian nobleman. He's actually our compatriot, as modern-day Latvia is part of the Russian Empire. And he was not one of the greatest best-known painters, but he created some historical portraits and other canvases inspired by motifs from European histories and myths. So this canvas, Prince Vladimir, was finished in 1822 in Verona, and the painter presented to Emperor Alexander I, who arrived there for the Holy Union Congress. The emperor liked an allusion to the words from the Primary Chronicle. Then came the Germans, asserting that they were come as emissaries of the Pope. They added, "Thus says the Pope, your country is like our country, but your faith is not ours, for our faith is the light. We worship God, who has made heaven and earth, the stars, the moon, and every creature, while your gods are only wood." Vladimir inquired what their teaching was. They replied, "Fast according to one's strength, but whatever one eats or drinks is all to the glory of God, as our teacher Paul has said." Then Vladimir answered, "Depart hence. Our fathers accepted no such principle." The emperor acquired the painting for the Winter Palace, and later Egging became member of the Imperial Academy of Arts. This was not his only painting on the subject. He authored another one, Grand Prince Vladimir Chooses Religion, in 988. And this painting is now in St. Andrew's Church in Kiev, but the draft of it is in the Latvian National Museum of Art. This painting is in an entirely different style. Vladimir is placed in the center, seated on a marble throne under a canopy, supported by spiral gilded columns. His face is in the shade. He seems to be watching the papal legates withdrawing in shame, a tonsured monk in white garb and a cardinal in red garment with a wide-brimmed hat supporting an elderly bishop. And to the right and close to the throne, there is an Orthodox bishop in shining gold embroidered clothing. He stands very close to the throne and is showing to Vladimir and the audience a huge open Bible, his triumphant. And in the background you see the stone towers and high walls of a medieval city, supposed to be Kiev. The canvas is anachronistic in its detail, because stone masonry wasn't known in Kievan Rus, and of course the clothes and furniture were largely inspired by Romantic paintings. But the underlying idea is very clear. It shows, through affinity to classical art and architecture, the link between the Byzantine and the Russian Empire. So Russian Empire appears as the Third Rome.
You touched on a very interesting issue, that of medievalism in the Russian Empire. Let's discuss that.
National Romanticism as a movement was basically the same all over Europe. It was an effort at nation building characterized by heightened interest in folklore and history, especially medieval history. You know probably about many of these phenomena in Europe, such as the collection of folk tales by the Brothers Grimm in Germany, the Victorian fascination with the Arthurian legend. Everybody knows Tennyson's Idylls of the King. And the French were building on Charlemagne, Saint-Louis, and all these medieval figures. And the Russian Empire was not exempt from this general tendency. For example, Alexander Pushkin wrote poems and plays which were devoted to events in the medieval history of Rus, such as the Lay of the Wise Oleg and the drama Boris Godunov. So this and other texts, historical events and motifs, were illustrated by Russian painters. The most famous of them is Viktor Vasnetsov, who also painted frescoes with saints and events from medieval Rus history in churches. Vasnetsov is the author of the iconic painting Bogatyrs, which depict Ilya of Murom, Dobrynin Nikitich, and Alyosha Popovich. And the painting is, of course, anachronistic in that the hero's historical prototypes belong to different generations and could have never met in real life. Neither do they meet in the folkloric text that treat their exploits, the Belinas. However, they became part of the Russian culture as the iconic trio of heroes who are defending the Rus land against innumerable evils. So most recently, the three heroes experienced a surge of popularity with the production of the Russian franchise of cartoon The Heroes, which included Ilya of Murom and Nightingale the Robber. And this is important cartoon for us because the cartoon started me and my colleagues on our quest for the Russian and Ukrainian medievalism. For it turns out that quite soon after The Heroes franchise enjoyed its successes, the Ukrainian statesmen, historians and creative industry workers also started on their own campaign of returning Ilya of Murom to his supposed homeland, Chernigov in Ukraine.
Before we plunge into the modern period and this fascinating tale of repatriation of Ilya of Murom, let us stay for a second in the 19th century Russian Empire. If I remember correctly, the first statue of Prince Vladimir in Kiev originates from that period.
Yes, you're right. And when I was talking about this Canadian-Ukrainian sculptor, Leo Moll, he must have been inspired by this statue of Saint Vladimir, even if his own statues are somewhat different style. So the monument of Vladimir the Great was begun by the Russian sculptor Vasily Demut-Malinovsky and was completed by another Russian-based German artist Peter Claude von Jürgensburg in 1853. And this bronze statue depicts Vladimir in a coat with a big cross in his right hand and the great prince hat in his left. So these are the symbols of his religion and his sovereign power. It's just under 4.5 meters and it stands on a 6-meter tall pedestal. The pedestal, it kind of takes us back to Egin's painting because it's made in a pseudo-Byzantine style. And again, we have allusions to the Byzantine Empire and continuities between the two empires, which are made prominent in art. So the statue was cast in St. Petersburg and had to be delivered to Kiev by water transport later in horse-drawn carts because there was no railway branch to Kiev yet. And we can see that Kiev wasn't a major center. It's kind of quiet backwater, it's his original center. if we look at contemporary documents, the erection of this statue wasn't uncontroversial. The church objected to erecting a pedestal and a statue to a repentant saint who had to be revered in churches and not in this statue in this secular context. Because if we look at chronicle accounts, Saint Vladimir wasn't a paragon of piety in his lifetime before he was converted. He was a known womanizer, he was reputed for cruelty, he wasn't very honest. These are features noted by chroniclers of Rus and also in foreign chronicles. But it seems that after his baptism, Vladimir grew so pious that he had to be even persuaded to execute criminals because he took this commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," very literally. So he's a penitent saint, basically, in this religious discourse and not a strong ruler. Eventually, the secular power of the Russian Emperor compromised by erecting a chapel to Saint Vladimir. But this wasn't the only controversy. From the aesthetic point of view, many residents of Kiev found the bronze statue was too bleak, not very distinct, and they made several attempts to make it more colorful. They tried illuminating it with gaslight. This looked probably quite weird because they didn't continue with this. And then they tried painting it in white, and again, it wasn't very successful. But as nationalist movements gained strength in Ukraine, and historical figures of Kievan Rus and Vladimir in particular were promoted, so the statue became one of the symbols of Ukrainian nationalism and national identity.
Knowing the current situation, the Russian government probably wasn't particularly happy by the fact that Ukraine had undisputed possession of such an important figure as the baptizer of Rus. And they decided to claim him back by erecting another and even bigger monument, didn't they?
Yeah, so that's another controversial monument to Vladimir. And of course, if we look at the timeline, 1988 wasn't the time when a historical saint would be glorified. It was still the USSR, the country which professed atheism. But we can remember there was another anniversary, 2015. It's the millennium since the death of Vladimir. So the government decided to celebrate it by erecting a monument to Vladimir in Moscow. And it was a very monumental monument, we can say so. It's 17.5 meters tall, so if you remember, the Kievan statue is just under 4.5 meters plus the pedestal. And the statue of Vlad in Moscow, it's also higher than statues to other historical figures which are standing nearby Alexander Nevsky Garden. There are the statues of Hermogenes and Alexander the First. And the unveiling ceremony for the statue of Vladimir the Great took place on November the 4th, 2016. It was a very, very pompous event. But again, as with the statue in Kyiv, it wasn't uncontroversial. Some church figures emphasized it wasn't appropriate to erect a monument to a prince who was, after all, a paragon of virtue before conversion, unlike Vladimir the Wise, with whom he sometimes conflated in popular discourse. And the place where the monument was erected was thought also not very appropriate because the statue was erected next to the protection zone of the Moscow Kremlin, and it was feared that Kremlin might be excluded from the UNESCO World Heritage List, but it didn't happen. It's still on the list. If we look at the statues, the Moscow Vladimir, like his Kievan double, holds a cross in his right hand, but that's the end of the similarities because in his left hand, this Vladimir holds a sword, and the other Vladimir in Kiev, he held a hat, the symbol of sovereignty.
Contemporary Russian art seems to have a thing for saints wielding swords.
Well, yes, there might be a connection. The statue of Vladimir was erected in 2016. At this point, you might see that the Russian Federation was viewing itself in terms of active military power, and you can see that the Russian Empire was projecting this image of we are heirs of the Byzantine Empire, we have this Byzantine style sovereignty, and the Russian Federation has a different public image, that of strong military power. And unfortunately, we saw what happened in Ukraine.
And this wasn't the only monument to Vladimir in Russia, was it?
No. So monuments to Saint Vladimir and other saints of the Russian Orthodox Church, they started to spring all around Russia. So even earlier than that, in 2007, an equestrian statue of Prince Vladimir was erected, and it was erected in the city of Vladimir. This monument has not only Vladimir, who is carrying a religious banner or harangue with an image of Christ, but also has Saint Theodore, who is walking at the rider's side, and it's placed on a watch platform, so it also offers a view of the city and its surroundings, a little bit like the position of the monument of Saint Vladimir in Kiev, but kind of smaller scale, so Vladimir is not as important as the city. And when we look at the sculpture and at the monument in its entirety, we can see that the pedestal of the monument includes the reliefs of a number of historical figures who were kind of thought by its creator that they were part of regional history. Some have a stronger connection, some have kind of not so strong connections. There are Andrei Bogolyubsky, Alexander Nevsky, Vsevolod III Yurievich, Princess Maria, Saint Princess Olga, Saint Sophia of Sousse, and surprise, surprise, there is also Ilya of Murom.
Now, I feel we could go on about the monuments for quite a while. So how about we move on to the next item of our list, the cartoon. I know our listeners will want to hear the story of Ilya of Murom and Nightingale the Robber. It is tremendously funny, and I highly recommend watching it, especially given the fact that it is available on YouTube with English subtitles. But it also has a statue. And what a statue it is! Statue of Prince Vladimir in gold.
A long time ago in Ruslan, there was a ruthless bandit, Nightingale the Robber. The brave and patriotic, but not very clever, Ilya of Murom. And the cunning and greedy, but not very brave, Prince Vladimir. The cartoon came out in 2007, the same year as the monument to Vladimir in Vladimir was erected, but in difference from the monument, which is somewhat suspect, this cartoon proved to be very, very popular.
Most likely because it's of much funnier and of much better quality.
Could be, yes. I would also dare say it's also outrageously politically incorrect. And under the current government in Russia, its authors would have most likely been arrested, and the cartoon would have never been screened. In those times, Vladimir Putin was still a democratically elected president, and he was supported by the majority of the citizens. But the cartoon shows the potential for an authoritarian turn of tide. It seems that the creators were very much aware that things might change. And in the cartoon, a number of political issues are criticized quite prophetically. One of them is censorship of journalists and historical writing. The other is corruption. Vladimir pockets the lion's share of the treasury, and he releases the criminal Nightingale in exchange for a bribe. Nightingale walks away with the money Vladimir was intending for his own use. He also takes Ilya's faithful horse, Borushka, and that's when the fun begins. You have to watch the cartoon, I'm not going to give you a spoiler. The link to the YouTube will be in the links section. There is also this statue. Nightingale and Ilya and Vladimir in close pursuit. They all go together, one after the other, to Byzantium. That's where Vladimir sees the life-size statue of the Byzantine Emperor Basileus, and the statue is in gold. So Vladimir decides to make one like it for himself. And at the end of the cartoon, as Vladimir listens to the account of Ilya's deeds and approves it, on the condition that his name is substituted for the name of Ilya, we can also get to see this famous statue. And we see it as a splendid statue cast in shiny gold. The right hand of the ruler is extended forward, showing the way. It must be an allusion to the statues of Vladimir Lenin that no Russian viewer would miss. And then a fly enters on the screen, and the fly lands on the hand of the statue. The camera zooms out, and we see that this famous monument is elbow high, and it stands on the windowsill. So this is the extent of Vladimir's pretensions at grandeur. And while he wants to appear as Vladimir the Great, kind of new emperor, he has neither the qualities nor the resources, the money appropriate for a great ruler. He is basically a rock.
The name Vladimir seems rather popular. There are two historical Vladimirs who tend to blend somewhat in popular culture, especially in the world of Belinas. Then there is Vladimir Lenin, of course, and now we have witnessed the confrontation of two Vladimirs, Vladimir Zelensky and Vladimir Putin.
Well, this might be coincidence. Also, literally, Vladimir, the name means the one who owns the world. I mean, Vladimir in the cartoon, there might have been some conscious allusion to the, not ruler, but president of Russia.
We have announced the story of attempted repatriation of Ilya of Murom by Ukrainian authorities. Perhaps we could discuss that before we wrap up.
So, Ilya is kind of international figure. You have the Russian Ilya, the Ukrainian Ilya, also the Finnish and the German and the Latvian Ilyas, so he's not confined to one nation. The story was really very popular, both historically in the early modern period, and of course it's still popular today. So, talking about the Ukrainian Ilya. Historically, the Belinas or folkloric tales about great heroes were composed all over Slavic-speaking territories of the Russian Empire, and actually before it became an empire, from the 17th century on. During the National Romanticism movement, Belinas were collected, and the largest number of them were collected in the Russian North. There was a scholar, Rybnikov, who collected Belinas in the Lanex County in the second half of the 19th century, and he even recorded the tales about Ilya from Tukarelian storytellers. And also Belinas about Ilya were collected in the southern regions, which are part of today's Ukraine. But the diversity of plots in these Belinas was actually less than that in the northern Belinas. So this could mean two things. Either the center for the development of the Belinas was the north and Ilya was more popular in the north, or simply there was more material preserved. At the same time, we know that Ukraine has no lack of its own heroes, heroes which also fight dragons like Ilya does. So maybe they didn't have that need of Ilya as a messianic hero.
Which makes sense in a certain way, since hero is called Ilya of Murom, and Murom was not a principality of Kiev.
It could be even more complicated. I would just tell that in 2017, something very interesting happened. It involved the Wikipedia, the World Encyclopedia, and also the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. According to the Ukrainian newspaper Vestnik and the Russian press, it seems that in 2017, the officials of the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense made corrections to the Russian language page of Wikipedia on Ilya of Murom, to create an impression that Ilya of Murom's legendary birthplace was the city of Chernigov in Ukraine and not in Murom. And this claim was invented recently. It's based on the research of 19th century scholars from the Russian Empire who proposed that Murom is the corruption of Moravel, a settlement near Chernigov. This hypothesis wasn't universally accepted, so it's anyone's guess whether he came from Moravel from Murom, because most versions they call him Ilya of Murom.
Well, fortunately, nothing is quite lost on the web, and we can check the changes as they happen.
Well, yes, we can, and Wikipedia gives a possibility to look up and compare all the earlier versions of any article, but the Russian language article on Ilya of Murom is very lengthy. It has been there for a long time, and it has been edited quite a few times. Tracing and analyzing these changes in terms of the nationalist political band would be a very interesting project. I'm just dropping a hint if anyone is interested. You can do some archaeological digging of Wikipedia. But we have checked the entries for 2017, and it seems some changes did take place there. In particular, there was a user identified by a sequence of numbers and not by a name, who changed the entry location in the side menu of the article from from Kiev and Rus to Ukraine, and this correction was later cancelled. There were other corrections, and just not going to go into details, it would be a bit boring. But the gist is that whoever was editing the article, and there might have been many users, they were going back and forth between Ilya being more Ukrainian and Ilya being more from Murom.
Well, that shows that both sides will stop at nothing to claim as many famous historical and legendary characters as they can.
Well, this should be appropriate historical and legendary characters, right? But yes, when we speak about Ilya of Murom, there have been many attempts to kind of integrate him, make him more recognizable as a Ukrainian hero on the local level. There is a fantasy movie produced in Ukraine called Guard Post, was also produced in 2017. And it centers on the adventures of a 21st century schoolboy, Vitya, who goes back to the time of the Belina heroes, and he meets Ilya of Murom, and they fight mythical monsters and so on. The film director Yuri Kovalev claimed in the interview that he has been delighted to discover that the three heroes of the Belinas were really Ukrainian national heroes. Actually shows that not all Ukrainians at the time recognized them as the Ukrainian national heroes. They needed a rediscovery. And I forgot to mention the fact that there is a monument to Ilya of Murom in Kiev. It was erected in 2018 on a small island which bears the hero's name. So again, this also shows that Ukrainian side also engages in creating some monuments, kind of keeping close to the Russian hills. In balance, you can see that both sides are recruiting historical events, characters, and even artifacts to help their cause. And we know how alarming some of the Russian claims have been. Now, the same year when the war broke out in 2022, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky issued an official statement on the Ukrainian Statehood Day, which is July 28th, where he referenced several historical names and events and claimed them as Ukrainian. So I'm going to quote the respective section. Every day we fight so that everyone on the planet finally understands. We are not a colony, not an enclave, not a protectorate, not a gubernia, an islet, or a crown land, not a part of foreign empires, not a part of the land, not a union republic, not an autonomy, not a province, but a free, independent, sovereign, indivisible, an independent state. It originates at least 1,500 years ago, since the day officially recognized by the UN and UNESCO, when Ki, Shnek, Horiv and Libit founded the capital of Ukraine. It is the only legal heiress of Kievan Rus, the possessions and achievements of our rulers. Askold and Dir, Vishy Oleg, Prince Igor, equal to the apostles, Princess Olga, Svetoslav the Brave, Volodymyr the Great, Yaroslav the Wise, Vladimir Monomakh, King Danilo. This is a very strong statement, but it has one problem, anachronism. Whatever the origins, no state can claim a millennial history because the concept of the nation-state is a modern phenomenon. The alleged founders of the capital of the modern-day Ukraine, and he named them Shek, Horiv and Libit, they are no less legendary figures than King Arthur of Britain or the founders of Rome, Romulus and Remus. As to the rulers enumerated, all of them, apart from the last one, King Danilo, are also part of Russian history, so that exclusive claim on them is bound to lead to conflicts. There is open question to what extent you can claim a historical figure as the exclusive possession of one nation. Sometimes it's not possible. And Zelensky claims that the exclusive possession of a number of certain important cultural and textual artifacts, later in this statement saying that his country, quote, has a rich tradition of lawmaking, writing and diplomacy. Ruskaya Pravda, Annales Bertiniani, Ostromir Gospels, Constitution of Pilip Arlik, and hundreds of other source documents that contain written references to our state and its recognition by other states and rulers, end of quote. I would like to stop at just one of them, Ostromir Gospels. which is a richly illuminated manuscript of the Gospels dated to 1056-1057, and according to the UNESCO description, it is the world's earliest dated East Slavonic manuscript book today. And I'm not sure if Mr. President put this artifact into the tradition of lawmaking, writing, or diplomacy, but the fact is that Ostromir Gospels are currently stored in the National Library of Russia. The artifact has been registered with UNESCO since 2011, following a nomination submitted by the Russian Federation in the same year. So claiming Ostromir Gospels as Ukrainian opens the potential to reclaiming this and other artifacts for Ukrainian museums, and this is something which Russia, under any government, is unlikely to grant. It's like waving a red rag in front of a bull.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of our talk. You have said a lot of provocative things which are unlikely to make anyone on any side happy.
Well, do you think historians are supposed to make people happy? We are neither demagogues nor entertainers. We should tell the truth or what we honestly believe to be true, no matter how ugly, inconvenient or offending it may seem. And no matter what the current political climate of the most recent book dictates. I try to be provocative, so people can bear something away from this discussion. Of course, we all present the truth in our own way. It's better to be provocative than trying to please everybody, I believe. We can conclude on this happy note and thank our listeners for bearing with us.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 3 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, and Logan Quigley, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with new episodes.